This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And the risk is of international spread is particularly great because the city of Mbandaka is in proximity of the Congo River.
That's Dr. Robert Stephan with the World Health Organization's Emergency Committee talking about the concerns over the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Details next. Also, as South Sudan peace talks continue in Ethiopia, South Sudanese refugees in Uganda are calling on the warring factions to make peace. And Burundi remains calm today after voters went to the polls yesterday in a national referendum on changing the constitution. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the World Health Organization has raised the threat level for the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo amid concerns that the deadly disease is spreading from the remote countryside to an urban area. The WHO says it doesn't want to fan panic and has decided not to declare a public emergency at this point. And it says it's encouraged by the quick response to the outbreak, both domestically and internationally. But it called the emergence of Ebola in the provincial capital of Mbandaka worrying due to the possibility of an explosive increase in such a contagious disease. The risk level for the DRC was raised from high to very high, WHO's second highest level. The risk level for the country's neighbors was raised to high after the WHO held an emergency meeting in Geneva today to assess the situation. Director Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus described the response.
And we were really encouraged by what we have seen on the ground. One, the government was coordinating, and it had already instructed its cabinet to focus on this. Partners are coordinated. Community committees are triggered, and community health agents are visiting house to house, village to village. They call them MRECO. And we have a mobile lab on the ground in Bikoro.
Dr. Robert Stephan, the chairman of the emergency committee, says the combined response has kept the situation from spinning out of control so far.
It was the view of the committee that the conditions for a public health emergency of international concern have not been met.
Still, Stephan explains that the risks remain high.
And the risk is of international spread is particularly great because the city of Mbandaka is in proximity of the Congo River, and that Congo River in today's newspaper I just read has been labeled as a highway, and that it is, you can travel on it to Kinshasa and across the border to Congo-Brazzaville. And that, of course, has a significant regional traffic across very porous borders there.
Late Thursday, the DRC's Ministry of Health said tests confirmed another 11 cases and 2 deaths, including one in a suburb of Mbandaka, which is home to more than a million people. The WHO called that development a game changer because of the possibility that the outbreak could expand quickly, both inside the DRC and to its neighbors.
The emergency committee advised the Director General that the Democratic Republic of Congo government, WHO, and partners should remain engaged in vigorous response, because without that, the situation is likely to deteriorate significantly.
Mbandaka is about 150 kilometers from the northwestern village of Bikoro, where the outbreak began. A total of 45 cases of Ebola have now been reported, 14 confirmed, 21 probable, and 10 suspected. The WHO, Doctors Without Borders, UNICEF, and others have dispatched medical teams to the area, along with 4,000 doses of a new vaccine that has proved promising in early tests. More doses are on the way. South Sudanese refugees in Uganda have called on warring factions in their country to make peace so they can go home. Their plea comes as another round of South Sudan peace talks gets underway in Ethiopia, steered by the East African bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD. A number of agreements have been signed before and later broken, the latest in 2017. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
Ugandan refugee settlements are home to more than 1 million South Sudanese who have fled fighting in their country. Uganda government and refugee agencies provide many of the necessities to help the refugees settle and start a new life. Still, many yearn to return home. Grace Madut, a 17-year-old from Kajokeji in South Sudan, breaks down in tears, remembering the family she left behind.
The life in the refugee camp is somehow so simple, but not that easy. When you are in the refugee camp, you think of what happened back at home, your relatives, and then others. I just wish to go back home, be with my relatives and everybody.
Madut is not alone. Bashandiru Araba is another South Sudanese refugee from Yeye River State. She wants peace to return to her motherland so her family can reunite.
I just the first person even like to go back when the feast come. What I miss, because, you know, relatives are not coming in the same place. Eh? Some relatives, they don't know where they go. So we divide us different. But now the what making me peace to go back, we can come all the relatives and combine in the same place.
Samuel Era is an elder among the Nuela tribe of South Sudan, but he lives now in Uganda's Bidibidi settlement. He says the long stay in the settlements puts their community's traits under attack. He says intermarriage is diluting the cultural values of various South Sudanese tribes in the settlements.
Our cultural marriages have changed. Now people don't marry their own, you know, cultural mates, and because of the setup of the refugee camps, you find your neighbor is from another tribe. If she is beautiful, you find that you will marry that one now.
The refugees are now calling for cessation of hostilities among leaders in the country so they can safely go home. Taban Wilson is from Kajokeji.
The government should really settle the issue amicably so that people go back. We will be very happy because it has taken a long.
Wadri Sam Nyakua is the chairperson of Arua District, where most of the South Sudan refugee settlements in Uganda are. He wants the world to do more to help the refugees and his community.
I want to appeal to the international community to invest yourselves in solving this problem back home in South Sudan. The UN has all the powers to put sanctions, to bring to order these warring factions. This aid and support and so on we're giving, yes, it is good, but it can help us and address the problem in South Sudan. It will be a very, very wonderful thing.
South Sudan's civil conflict began in December 2013 when political disputes between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar turned violent. The latest round of peace talks opened Thursday in Ethiopia and are expected to run through Monday. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Rights activists in Ghana and the Gambia are pushing to bring the former Gambian president, Yahya Jammeh, to justice. Jammeh has been accused of being involved in the murder of over 50 West African migrants in July of 2005, many of whom were Ghanaians. One of the survivors of the incident is working with human rights groups so he can push to have Jammeh extradited from Equatorial Guinea to face justice in Ghana. VOA's Pandera Mbai reports.
Reed Brody, a senior lawyer at Human Rights Watch based in the United States, is among those leading the campaign against former Gambian President Yahya Jammeh.
We recently investigated the 2005 massacre of over 50 West African migrants. These men and women, mostly from Ghana, were trying to reach Europe but ended up stranded on the Gambian coast. Jammeh's security services warned of a potential coup, deemed the migrants to be mercenaries, and they were arrested and brutally killed. Their bodies were dumped in wells and in bushes.
Human Rights Watch says it had interviewed 30 Gambian officials, including 11 directly involved in the incident. Martin Kairi was among the Ghanaian migrants arrested in the Gambia. He says Gambian forces took them north from the town of Banjul. Martin managed to escape from Jammeh's most feared military team, the junglers.
The car was about to stop and I jumped from the pickup and I heard a noise back there. Who is that? Who is that? But I did not look back. I started running harder. About 4 to 5 steps, I was tied back down by a rope and a gunshot follows and passes over me.
He found his way to neighboring Senegal before safely returning to Ghana. Human Rights Watch says that the United Nations and the Economic Community of West African States investigated but concluded that the Gambian government was not directly or indirectly complicit in the deaths and disappearances. Instead, the ECOWAS report said that rogue elements in Gambia's security services acting on their own were probably responsible. Marion Volkman is a human rights consultant working with an organization called Gambia's Victim Center. She told reporters this week the ECOWAS report was flawed from the start. There is evidence, she says, the Gambian government destroyed police and navy records and travel logs.
The new evidence today shows exactly the contrary. Basically, our investigation showed a consistent body of evidence linking the President Jammeh to the killings and making him the prime suspect in that. It's therefore our hope that the Ghanaian authorities will reopen the investigation in that case and will eventually ask for the extradition of Yahya Jammeh.
Yahya Jammeh was in power for 23 years, and his administration has been accused of numerous rights violations, including forced disappearances, torture, and killing of political opponents. Sidi Njie was information minister under Jammeh. He says this case has been settled.
Remember when former President Jammeh was in power, there was intense negotiations and dialogue between the then government of Ghana and also the Gambia government and the United Nations. And at one point in time, there was an agreement reached and then Gambia government paid compensation through the Ghanaian government. And as far as we are concerned, that matter was laid to rest by the two government and plus the United Nations.
Njie also says Jammeh reached an agreement with ECOWAS and the United Nations before he gave up power peacefully last year, and that included a pledge that he would not be harassed or prosecuted. For VOA Africa, this is Panderimbay reporting.
Burundi remains calm today after voters went to the polls yesterday in a national referendum on changing the constitution. The changes include extending the presidential mandate from 5 to 7 years and creating a prime minister's post. If adopted, the changes will give President Pierre Nkurunziza a chance to run for 2 more terms. Nkurunziza has ruled Burundi since 2005. Burundi has been rocked by political violence since Nkurunziza ran for a 3rd term in 2015, defying critics who said he was violating the constitution and the agreement that ended the country's civil war. The government says the constitutional changes are needed to provide a clear direction on the term limit issue. Today, the U.S.-based group Human Rights Watch said at least 15 people died and 6 were raped during the campaign ahead of the vote. The group's report says security forces and their allies created a climate of fear and intimidation, targeting opponents of the changes. However, many voters support Nkurunziza, saying the former rebel leader has maintained peace in the country. The Electoral Commission has until Saturday to announce the result of Thursday's vote. As Liberia continues to recover from the physical, psychological, and emotional effects of more than a decade of civil conflict, the Carter Center Foundation has been partnering with the country's government to help people suffering mental illnesses. VOA's Kim Lewis visited an organization in Monrovia that is helping people to help others.
The Carter Center-supported program Cultivation for Users Hope, or CFUH, is Liberia's only mental health service organization that offers patients the opportunity to become leaders and mentors to others with mental illnesses. I visited the organization in Monrovia and spoke with two members who have been able to turn their lives around and help others. Bill Galla was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 1976 and has been part of the program since 2010. He says he didn't know what type of illness he had until he went through the program. Now, with ongoing treatment and an understanding of his illness, he is able to lead a productive life where he helps others to do the same.
Indeed, this program has improved my life tremendously. I was trained first by the Carter Center Mental Health Program. The training was all about us learning about our illness and helping ourselves know more about the illness so that we can know how to maintain our health and they help other users whom we will come in contact with.
Sydney Flomo, the vice president of Cultivation for Users Hope, was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 2007. Flomo said he first learned how to accept that he suffered from a mental disorder, then how to manage it with medication and treatment guidelines. He said he is now able to help others.
I'll see a great prospect in my life in the future. Right now, I'm studying web design and database management. Yeah, so I see a good future for myself. It's because of this program, you know, it has brought a tremendous change in my life and the way I see things. Because initially, I just thought that all hope was lost. Carter Center came in the picture and had hope.
With passage last year of Liberia's Mental Health Act, many Liberians with mental illnesses will get a chance to lead a normal life. However, diagnosis and treatment involve understanding some of the causes. For many Liberians, the psychological impact of more than a decade of civilian conflict contributed to a mental health crisis, which has been intensified by misconceptions, stigma, and the resulting discrimination surrounding mental illnesses. The Ebola crisis exacerbated the lack of mental health care training for health professionals and inadequate supplies of necessary medication. Dr. Francis Kete is Deputy Minister of Health Services and Chief Medical Officer for Liberia. He says the country's repeated trauma has taken its toll.
Just to go back a little, mental health in Liberia is something that is very, very close to my heart. One is that Liberia went through a civil crisis. Then after that, Ebola. And because of that, many people are being traumatized. If you look at what the normal situation will be, Liberia will be a little higher because of the crisis Liberia has gone through. So that brings us to the many mental problems in the country.
Some of the consequences of years of trauma include increased violence against women and drug addiction in young people.
Among the young people, you also have the rampant abuse of drugs. And so there is a serious need of trying to bring some stability to the country, and whatever help that we can get, basically that will help us to minimize the damage that the country may go through in the future.
Barkan Dwa is a national consultant for mental health and substance abuse for the World Health Organization. He also provides technical support for the Carter Center. He said while marijuana use is common, heroin is far worse.
Heroin is next to, you know, marijuana, and that's the one that's causing the most harm, and it's been used in a very high quantity here. It's been used in our own local preparations and everything. For example, we have something like peanut, and we use with gari here. There are places in town where you will find that they will even put some of those things in it.
Dwa said he has seen heroin addiction begin in children as young as 10 because it's readily available at social events. However, through programs such as the Carter Center's efforts, more awareness of mental health issues and addictions is being brought to the forefront. Kim Lewis, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
Cervical cancer is the biggest killer of women in Zimbabwe. so the government has been rolling out the human papilloma virus vaccination for adolescent girls to cut the risk that they contract the disease. Reporter Kuzai Zanawash has the report.
Dr. Portia Manangazira is the Director of Epidemiology and Disease Control in the Ministry of Health and Childcare. She explains why they are taking a stand against cervical cancer by vaccinating against the human papilloma virus, also known as HPV.
Zimbabwe is among the 10 most burdened countries regarding cervical cancer. And our statistics from our National Cancer Registry actually show that cervical cancer is our biggest killer of women in Zimbabwe and is the most common cancer.
She adds that this has been coupled by the poor health sector, resulting in late diagnosis of cervical cancer cases. The vaccination proves a better option than a cure, as Zimbabwe's health sector does not have the capacity to treat thousands of cervical cancer patients. Thousands have already benefited from the program, and thousands more are set to be vaccinated. Manangazira says most parents have been supportive thus far.
So we have quite a lot of support from parents, and some of the parents appreciate that he's protecting their daughters against cancer. So they've been quite forthcoming. We do, however, have a few that have been refusing, but we also realize it may be inadequate information.
Manangazira cites some cases where parents have returned with their daughters for vaccination after noting the benefits. She adds that those who make up their mind late will still be able to get vaccinated, but in the private sector. Auxilia Kuziza is a mother of two adolescent girls and says while the program is welcome, more age groups should have benefited from the program.
It's a good move that should be applauded from the government. This should have been done long back, and I think something that should also benefit not only the young girls, but also even those that are already beyond that age that is being targeted.
Girls between the ages of 10 and 14 are the ones being targeted. But Kuzidza says all age groups are vulnerable and prone to being affected by cervical cancer. Zimbabwe reports 1,500 to 2,000 new cervical cancer cases annually, with a mortality rate of 64%. About 7,000 cancer cases are reported annually, and there are only a handful of hospitals that can treat cancer patients. To some patients in remote areas, that means they have to travel to urban centers for routine treatment and checkups. The cliche that prevention is better than cure could not be truer in this case. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News, coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com,
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.